edited or written more than 60 books on war game. Quite impressive. And as I understand, your most destructive war game has been a nuclear attack on the UK. I'm glad it's not on Sweden, that. And the saddest one was about the former Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
And you also made a big war game regarding the civil war in Libya. What's very important to know is that John Curry is also the editor of the War Gaming Project, where he tries to collect the key elements of war games in order to make ease the development of both hobby war gaming and professional war gaming. And John Curry is now going to have a talk for us about the relationship between hobby and professional war gaming. So please, John.
Okay. So, the nuclear attack on the UK, it's interesting, when we got the Russian nuclear attack plans, they actually missed some major targets in the UK, so we did actually keep some secrets from them. I think that's absolutely fascinating. The Libyan Civil War game, the only problem was, it was right at the Defence Academy, we actually failed to identify any sensible strategies for NATO except don't land ground forces. But we had the optimum strategy for Colonel Gaddafi. In fact, it was run twice, wasn't it? And we had the optimum strategy twice for Colonel Gaddafi. So, I thought that was interesting. So, 19th century. In the emergence of wargaming, there was no difference between the hobby and professional games. For example, this illustration, it shows an innovation in Kriegsspiel. It was a civilian illustration saying, well, if you haven't got time, you only want to do it in the evening, but a board in between the two sides, all working around one map, umpires describing the open stages what you can see on the other side, take the board away after half an hour. And it's interesting, there's civilian players there and military players there. The Fred Jane Naval War Game, well, that was a classic war game, and that had Navy personnel were there as well as civilians. There was no difference. So what I'm going to do is try this massive topic. What I'll try and do is use some case studies to illustrate some of the issues around this interesting thing. I'm going to mention the commercial computer games, and I'll also note about board games being used for leadership training. So hopefully within a mere 15 minutes from now, I'll have said a few interesting things. Credibility. The first thing is, if you want to use a commercial hobby game, it's got to be credible. So the Fletcher Pratt Naval War Game, which was played 1930 to 1945, this is an illustration on the floor, it's toy ships, isn't it? You estimate the range in inches to hit. I mean, that's ridiculous. But actually, the game was treated with massive credibility at the time. But they had regular participation of naval staff, and one of the key was Fletcher Pratt's wife inviting along the Admiral for the South Atlantic, that's the American Admiral for the South Atlantic, along with his staff to play in the game. So who in the Navy would possibly have the nerve then to have criticised the Fletcher Pratt Naval War Game? Pratt had also seen combat in the Pacific. I quite like this image taken by the photographer stood next to Fletcher Pratt, which is showing the kamikaze pilot trying to hit the carrier, which Pratt is actually on the bridge of. That gives you a certain credibility as a game designer, doesn't it? Now, professional games and hobby games. If you're going to use a hobby game, you need to be able to roll it back. It's a training game. So this is from an unpublished photograph from the Naval War College, 1944 to 1945. Commander Bothwell on the left-hand side, who was the last of the Fletcher Pratt players. I interviewed him a few years ago before he passed away. He made a classic mistake with the war game, and so another officer is then explaining to him the error of his ways, and they simply rolled the game back. So when you're playing one of these games, if you're starting to learn the wrong lessons, or one side have made a hopeless mistake, and let's face it, if you've got non-war gamers, they're probably going to make a hopeless mistake on turn one, you need to roll it back, because you're there for training value, not just entertainment. SBI Firefight is a classic example of a hobby game, which is also used professionally, or a professional game, which was also used as a hobby game. Notice the empty battlefield, as in large areas of empty terrain. Now, it was a small unit training game designed for the US Army in 1974, so James Dunningham obviously then published it commercially in 1976. The training areas were accurately portrayed, except for the fact they removed the swamps and other line-of-sight blocking terrain. And this was because the US Army was trying to promote the anti-tank guided missiles, in particularly those which the infantry had, as in on the ground. And so it would be very inconvenient, wouldn't it, if you kept on having the blocked line of sight. So you had these very clear battlefields. They omitted the doctrine rules because clearly everyone knew how the Russians would fight and how the Americans would fight. But the problem is then when you take it to the hobby domain, are they going to do the same? And I quite like the morale rules were omitted on the grounds the United States Army said the American Army always obeys orders and never routs. So James Dunningham stood his ground and said, well, if that's the case, well, the Russians aren't going to have morale rules either. And the rules were actually full of military jargon, things the hobby players couldn't understand, such as accurate delay for artillery, target opportunity, pre-registering targets, military jargon and procedures which the hobby gamers thought, well, couldn't you get rid of these? So shortly after the game was produced and published in the hobby domain, there was a simpler set of rules which got rid of all these military things but kept the inherent mechanics of the game. So that's one of the key differences. It's the omission of the procedures, the military tactics, the military doctrine, because the hobby games may or may not know about those. Now, let's just look at a few off-the-shelf games about modern warfare. And I'm just going to mention decision games, not because I have any financial connection with them yet, because I haven't cashed the check. Now, they produce a magazine, and they produce every 2 months one game on Cold War, modern warfare, and... Yeah, so it's World War II, ancient warfare or ancient, pre-World War II, and modern warfare. So this is an interesting one. Now, they've got a game about Target Iran, which is the premise is that Iran has weapons of mass destruction and America, with allies, decides to bomb Iran. Now, interestingly enough, it's a game which would be very difficult to circulate in the professional world. Now, it has many interesting ideas, and one of the innovations in there, they had the first really good example of how to play cyber in an operational level war game. So they could have about cyber could be used to conduct information war, so influencing the other side, starting revolt in Iranian cities, crashing enemy units as in interfering with their computers. They had the idea of the epic success and epic fail. So sometimes cyber can exceed beyond your wildest expectations. For example, something could go viral. Or sometimes it could backfire on you and people realise what you're doing is propaganda and it devalues your cause. But interestingly enough, they actually included something where you could actually use cyber to destroy a unit. And really, that's utter nonsense in today's terms. Let's look at another one. Red Dragon, Green Crescent, unlikely event of a war versus China or versus Iran. It's a very good game. It's indicative of what could actually happen. However, in the rules, you're only allowed to, you can move one task force at a time, then the other side moves the task force. So what you end up doing is you move your main task force multiple times and the rest of the United States fleet does nothing because you're moving one fleet, they're moving one fleet. So, this illustrates another interesting point. Campaign for North Africa, complexity and time. Now, this was a monster game produced by SBI. What more can I say about it? Well, I think any board game which includes a role for someone to manage the prisoners of war which you get during the game and has a rule that the Italian units need more water because of the amount of spaghetti they have in their rations... You know, now, if I did something silly like hand it out to a dozen people in the audience, because of your hobby background, I'm absolutely certain that within half an hour someone would have the maps out and we're putting out counters, and by the end of the morning or the end of the afternoon, you'd definitely have the first few turns played. You'd muddle your way through. But if you're aiming to try and use hobby games for the professional market, you really need to think about the duration you've got and to simplify it, as Phil has already referred to. So, commercial computer games. There are a series of commercial computer games out there which are a potential utility. The classic one is VBS. The civilian version is Arma 3. The first-person shooter, which is used for dismounted infantry combat in the British Army by the American Marines. It's used in Australia, New Zealand, etc. But it's not just a first-person shooter. It's actually realistic. So they've made some changes to the standard first-person shooter to reflect military training objectives. Is it realistic? Well, I tried it out on 30 undergraduates in a realistic scenario against 5 Taliban, and the kill ratio was 9-1. So each person playing the game got killed on average 9 times before that platoon of 30 managed to kill the Taliban. So that demonstrates why you need to train, why untrained infantry soldiers are ineffective in urban combat. I think we'd actually put it out into the public domain, actually, and it might discourage people from going to Syria. Now, commercial computer games. This is an example, last update in 2006. And it was very interesting. It was map-based, units, NATO symbols, etc. It was quite interesting. But what they discovered was the fact if you put out a game for the civilian market, your sales will be 10 to 100 times greater than if you try and put something out to the professional market. So the product survived for a little while. It's still out there, but it's not been updated. Close combat. I mentioned this because Slytherin's still here? Yeah. So this is one of the Slytherin games. And this is at unit level, and it's real time. So the utility of this game is forcing people to make very quick decisions. You've got your platoon, the game started, the firing's happening, you've got to start issuing orders very quickly. So that's its position in the marketplace. So, hobby games can be useful, but you need to have clear learning objectives, as Bob Cordray was starting to talk about. You need to scrutinise the rules, because do they make military sense? Because practically every game I've looked at, if you look at the detail of it, you realise they have some military nonsense in there, and they have it in there to make it more fun, more game-like. You need to simplify it, and then simplify it again. You need to shift the focus to planning and analysis. Because hobby gamers, you put the game down, and they'll start to play immediately. But what do we need to do? We need to think about the planning, evaluate the different courses of action. You need to issue military-like orders. And afterwards, you need an after-action review. You also need to tackle the role of dice, which has been talked about multiple times in this conference. And the duration, time is valuable, and the hobby games are designed to eat time. You also must think about active umpiring, and do you allow the umpire to roll back the game if you're starting to go down the wrong route and they're learning the wrong lessons from the game, or they've done something which means the game will carry on for 2 hours, but they're not going to know for it because they've made a classic mistake in game turn one. So, there is a gap in the market for games, potentially, on all these different subjects, and this is just my initial thoughts. In the past, there have been some really interesting military training games which have been used in the hobby market, but we don't have many examples out there at the moment. And I think we're just at the cusp of people producing it. I mean, Slytherin Games are looking at close combat and updating the game engine. Maybe that'll have a space in the professional market. And I'm 100% certain there's some people out there in the audience now who've got games which will become very widespread and well used for training in the next few years. Now, final points. There is a wider pool of hobby gamers out there who are potentially useful. And I'm not talking about pulling wargamers off the street. I'm talking about people who might, for example, be in the military already, or in defence-related industries, or done an MSc in conflict studies, etc. These people can be really useful at the right moment. So I was asked to create a game at a cities conference, about city resilience conference. What did I do? Well, I recruited people who knew something about resilience. Major Moak, for example. Russell King, an emergency planner. I recruited futurologists. But what they all had in common is they were all game designers and could assist me producing a training game to embed in the conference to assist what was going on. So one of the challenges is how do we include these hobby gamers as appropriate? The second advice is we need to publish. The act of actually preparing a game for publication forces you to develop the game further and to write down all those things which you keep in your head which are necessary to turn what you've got is very interesting into a useful product. Graham. You know, all that information about how to set up the game and how to define these different things and how to devise the unit size and assess their strengths, all these sort of things. But if you publish it, that's forces you to do that. We have a number of games which I've seen, and they are all ready potentially for publication. And the act of putting them out there would make them part of the record. The professional market will use it, but also the hobby gamers will pick them up. And remember, many of those hobby gamers who play that sort of game will be in the military, they'll be in the MOD, they'll have a master's in international relations. They'll look at it and they'll start to mod it, they'll start to offer suggestions, and some of those will be of utility to the people who produce the game. So your next iteration of the game will be improved because you're using the free market and the wider expertise to improve the quality of your product. The hobby is still producing useful innovations and probably matrix games that have been the classic one of the moment. And there's going to be another interesting innovation very shortly by Christmas, but I won't say anything more about that now. But hopefully it'll be on a par with matrix games. Now I want to finish with something completely different. It's mentioned by Phil already. The NATO Air Power Competence Centre in Germany uses board games for teaching leadership and communication. He uses them, as he says, it's very useful for officers to read and learn something which is quite complex, put them in an unfamiliar situation, an ancient or a medieval war game or a Napoleonic war game, and suddenly everything they know in this unfamiliar combat situation about the principles of war, such as the maintenance of the aim, the importance of communication to the reserves, it all goes out the window when they're under pressure. And the psychologists he have watching them debrief them afterwards and say, do you realise this was a combat situation? So why did you forget to brief your subordinates in a manner which they would expect to hear a brief military briefing? So that's really interesting. That's using historical board games for leadership and communications training. So hopefully in my random tour through the professional use of recreational games, I've hoped you made you think. There are games out there, but at the moment, I don't think there are many which are of utility without extensive modification to change them into a training tool for what we want.